Hi, I'm Seth Juarez, and I'm in Gold Coast, Australia. We are here in Gold Coast, Australia to meet with Troy Hunt, a well-known security expert and the dude that made haveibeenpwned.com. All right, let's go in. Troy Hunt, how you doing, buddy?
Good.
It's good to see you, man. Can I come
right
in?
In Australia, come on in.
First time in Australia, it's really hot here, dude.
You just realized this.
All right, well, where do you work?
All right, let's go upstairs. All right. The sit-down formal office. Because my office is very often by the pool.
Yeah, oh, right? Well, so, yeah, okay.
And, you know, mostly because I like context switching. I don't like just sitting there in the one place the whole time. I have trouble staying still. So the normal sort of formally office is in here.
Dang.
Which has all the monitors and the comfy chair. And so this is where I do...
This is where all the magic happens. Is that the microphone you use for your Pluralsight?
That's a lot of it. So that is the microphone I use for my Pluralsight. In fact, the microphone is presently adorned with the little Spider-Man here that I also use when I do my weekly videos. So I carry this around the world and do little videos.
Hold on. Wait a minute. I'm looking at these things that says Chinese Kung Fu Academy. What is this?
That is Chinese Kung Fu Academy.
So you could beat me up right now in front of
me. I don't think it'll come to that here. But I don't know. It's early yet.
Yeah, it's still early. Well, awesome.
Wait and see.
All right. Well, let's have a sit down and look at some of the stuff that you do.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So we're here with Troy Hunt in his house, in his office. And I wanted to talk to you about two things that you work on. One of the biggest things that you work on is Pluralsight. I saw the Certified Ethical Hacking course with like 1,000 courses that I was going to want to get to eventually, but I haven't started watching. How did that come about?
Okay, so the Certified Ethical Hacker stuff. So this was early 2015, I was over in Utah. We had this author summit and they said, look, we really want you to create a bunch of material for the Certified Ethical Hacker syllabus.
Okay.
So that there is a thing called CEH. And they wanted me to create a bunch of material and another guy to create a bunch of material that was more sort of the traditional malware analysis kind of realm, because it was the number one requested content in the library. So they had a user voice where you could go in and say, I want to see, you know, this or that or whatever, the latest Angular, the latest .NET, whatever. Had a user voice for that, and the ethical hacking stuff was by far and away the most requested material, which made me really happy from a security perspective that so many people wanted security content. Also made me very happy that they wanted me to build a lot of it. So that is what I did for most of 2014 and, oh no, 2015 and 2016.
Because there's a lot of courses in there.
Yeah, so I think I did about 8 courses in there. And every one of these courses as well is weeks and weeks of work in amongst doing other normal things.
Sure.
And then along with all the other ones as well, I think we've got a total of around about 20 courses in the Certified Ethical Hacking syllabus.
It's like 80 hours or something?
I think it's closer to 100. It's 90 something. So what it means is if people want to get this certification, this CEH certification, they can go through, do the material. You've still got to go to the EC Council and actually do the test to make sure that you've actually learned some stuff. But it sets you on the path to do that. And it's really interesting how many people, not just in security professions, but in development professions, have now said, like, this is our goal, we're going to do this. And I'm seeing companies, I was with a company in Belgium just the other day, who said, we're going to get a bunch of our developers to do this because this is a value proposition to our customers.
Right.
Because we want our customers to come to our particular software development shop, and they're going to get more secure software than the competitor, and it's a point of difference now.
Right. So, I mean, I looked at that, and I had a couple of questions when I was doing some. So, does that count as an official course when you go and take the test?
Well, in terms of taking the test, you've got to have the demonstrated competency. So, Pluralsight has a lot of training material, not just for the EC Council stuff, but for Microsoft certifications, Cisco certifications, all sorts of different certs. So you can go and get the material from there and get the knowledge and then go to the official provider and actually do the assessment.
So what is a certified ethical hacker, and why is it something that programmers should look into? I know I did. I'm like, I should look into this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So I guess as a premise, it's building up security capabilities to help you better better enact your role in the software capacity as a developer building secure software. A lot of people get the CEH cert who are dedicated security pros as well. And there are industries out there that require this specific cert in order for you to have a role there. So if you want a security role with the Department of Defense, for example, you need to have CEH. It's a very well recognized cert. The EC Council has done a very good job of promoting it. They market it very well. So a lot of companies know that there is this CEH thing, and that's what they want to try and get people who have skills with.
So if you're a developer looking at doing the Certified Ethical Hacker, what are some things in there that maybe developers don't think about? Give me one or two things.
So I would say that the biggest is the first CEH course I did, which is on SQL injection. So we know that SQL injection just gets exploited left, right, and center. Like every day I'm seeing data breaches that have come from SQL injection attacks. So that's one of the things that I don't think about. And that is about 5.5 hours, just that one course, just on SQL injection. Because it's a big topic.
I know that my first gray hat thing that I did was SQL injection. Somebody hijacked my customer's database. And it was access, and I put like a semicolon, select star, whatever. I caused an error, and it turned out to be an access database that was read-write, and it showed me the exact path, so I just downloaded the file.
Yeah, and this is a crazy thing, because you say it, and it sounds really simple, and it is really simple. So I've been doing some talks on travel recently where I show videos of children teaching people how to do SQL injection, and we're talking like 15, 16-year-old kids. And you know they're kids because their voices haven't quite broken.
Yeah.
And these kids are going through literally doing Google Doc searches. So very carefully crafted searches to find, say, websites with query strings that are PHP. They find the result, they go to the page, they put an apostrophe in the URL. So one character, right? One character, they get an error message on the screen. Now they don't know what it means. In fact, the kid whose video I show, he keeps referring to it as squirrel injection. Which I love. I think it's hilarious.
I'm calling it squirrel injection from here on out.
It sounds a lot less ominous when it's squirrel injection. So anyway, he's found the squirrel injection risk. He takes the URL, he drops it into free software, and he just sucks all the data out of the system. And it's that simple. It just happens in minutes.
So I think that's a good segue of sucking data out of the system into this thing you've built that was actually featured in, what was the name of the publication?
BuzzFeed.
That was published in BuzzFeed. HaveIBeenPwned.com. Like, how did you come up with this?
So this went back to late 2013, and I was doing a lot of analysis of data breaches because I was looking for patterns. And I wanted to sort of see what can we derive from data breaches that might tell us a little bit about how people manage their accounts. So I was looking for things like reused passwords, and you know, guess what? People reuse their passwords a lot. But what I was finding was quite interesting.
You probably are too. They're all looking at each other in the back. Wait, we're not supposed to reuse passwords? Shame them. Shame them all.
The unfortunate thing is, and I hate saying it, but you guys are normal. You're wrong, but you're normal. So they reuse passwords. And I was seeing all this and I went, what's interesting is I see the same people, because now I know they're reusing passwords, right? Same people in multiple breaches. And I'm going, I wonder if they know that they're in the Adobe breach, as well as multiple other breaches. So I decided to create this system, and I started out with sort of, I think it was about 152 million accounts, because there was Adobe, which was like 150, which seemed massive at the time. In fact, if I scroll down a bit, I'll get my figures right. Adobe was 152 million, and I think there were several million from other breaches, so I might have about 155 million total.
So let's pause there. So when you say breaches, like, somebody did this squirrel injection, a 15-year-old, downloaded this data, and where does this data go? I mean, like, how do you get it? How do other people get it?
Onto the internet. So, and this is the thing, right? There's many different ways that the data gets redistributed. Adobe, when that system was breached and the data taken out of there, it got shared pretty extensively online. So it gets torrented very quickly. It gets put on free download sites. It gets distributed over the dark web on Tor. It appears in many different places. And when we sort of scroll down a bit and have a look at some of these breaches, this is just the top 10, and we look at things like Dropbox. So when Dropbox got breached originally in 2012, then the data appeared in 2016, that data was being sold. So it was being sold on dark market websites. It got sold enough times that eventually someone has it who then redistributes it publicly. Same with LinkedIn. LinkedIn was being sold They wanted 5 Bitcoin at the time for the LinkedIn data. That started getting sold to enough people that eventually someone's leaked it, and now you can download it from just about anywhere.
And so why would people want to buy this? I mean, I want you to give people an understanding of why this is a horrible thing.
Yeah, so I think the pertinent question here is what is the value in data? Like, right. Who would actually pay for the data? And there are multiple parties. So one is that when you have access to, say, the LinkedIn accounts, which stored passwords in a weak SHA-1 fashion, and you can get a lot of these passwords cracked. LinkedIn is 164 million plus records here. You've now got 164 million email address and password pairs. And not all the passwords got cracked, but a significant portion of them got cracked.
But I thought SHA-1 passwords couldn't be reverse cracked.
Oh, no.
No, seriously, this is like a developer. Like, when you're storing, like, I've learned, and I know he's giving me the side eye, and he's giving you the side eye too, because maybe you thought this too. When I'm storing passwords, I'm like, oh, I'll just do a SHA-1 hash, which is supposedly a conversion that changes your password, like my password, and it puts it into some block of just bits.
So we've sort of gone through an evolutionary process with password storage where we originally had a lot of systems in plain text, and then we went, well, hang on a second, if the system gets breached,
you get your password.
Zero protection. Now, an important distinction here is that whether we're talking about plain text or the hashing algorithms we'll talk about in a moment, we have to have something go very badly wrong in the first place to actually get whatever is stored in the database.
Right.
Like, something has to go catastrophically wrong. So say it's SQL injection, gets all the passwords, if it's plain text, zero protection. So we said, all right, well, what we should do is we should hash it. And a hash is a one-way deterministic algorithm.
Which I thought was good, right?
Well, aspects of it are good. So what is good is that being one way, you can't take the output of the hash and unhash it.
Right.
And part of the reason of that is that every single hash is a fixed byte length. So whether it's a 2-character password or a 5,000-character password, it all outputs into the same number of bytes, depending on the hashing algorithm. So you can't reverse it. And it's deterministic in that you can always feed in the same value and get the same output. So what we said is, when someone registers, we'll get their password, we'll hash it, we'll store that in the database. Then when they come and log in, we'll get the password they provide at login, we'll hash that with the same algorithm. Because it's deterministic, we can then match the one in the database, and if they match, we go, hey, good, we're in. And then we went, well, this is a bit of a problem, because once we know the plain text value for a particular hash, so for example, someone says, well, most people have a password that is bad. One of the most common passwords is ABC123. So we will figure out the I know.
If you have that password, he's going to find you.
don't use that password. So we'll say ABC123. Once you hash that and you get the output and you've got these two pairs, or you've got this pair together, if ever you see that hash, then you know that the plain text value is ABC123.
So can you do like a lookup of a hash?
Yeah, in fact, there's a number of different ways you can do this. Now, one way is that we had these things called rainbow tables. And rainbow tables were pre-computed hashes. So someone would say, let's get all of the, say, 6 to 10 character lowercase alphanumeric possible strings. We'll hash them all with SHA-1. We'll get trillions and trillions of results, but we have this big lookup now, this dictionary, plain text hash. And then when a system gets cracked or broken into, we'll take those hashes, we'll compare them to the dictionary, and then we'll know what the plain text is. Now, it's not just that, but let's do a demo, because demos are fun. If we go into, say, create MD5 hash, and we'll find various resources to do this, here's an MD5 hash generator.
And I thought MD5 was like one of the good ones, right? And SHA-1 as well.
No, all bad. We'll get back to white. So if we imagine that you created a password with a 0 instead of an O, so the hackers don't know what it is.
Right, of course.
Don't do that.
Okay.
All right, so here is the MD5 hash, right? This value just here. Now, if we were to copy that and do a Google search for it, we'll find all of these websites that will tell you exactly what the value is. Now, you know, we'll make it more interesting, because password with a 0 is kind of crappy anyway. What's another bad password that you think people commonly use, but maybe not quite as bad as that?
ABCD1234.
ABCD1234. Okay, so that would be the hash that you'd store in the database. So we could take that, we could go back to here, let's Google search that one. Okay, and here we go. So here's all these results. Now we'll go down to here, and we'll load one of these sites, and it goes, hey, whoops, that's the wrong thing. Let's do a Control F. Okay, so there's that MD5 hash, and here is the plain text value. And there's a SHA-1 hash of it as well.
So you
literally, like, what everything I thought I was doing as a programmer, I'm a good programmer. I'm hashing my password, and I'm not storing. I don't know what your password is. You have to reset it. This complete garbage and nonsense.
Well, we sort of saw this, and we went, okay, the problem here is we got too much predictability. Because we know that every time you use the password ABCD1234, you will get this MD5 hash and this SHA-1 hash. So then we said, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to use a salt. And a salt is just random bytes. And we go, okay, depending on what system you're using, different number of random bytes, we might take, say, 16 random bytes. So what happens now is you register, you provide your password, the system goes, I'm going to generate these random bytes. I'm going to add them to your password, and then we'll hash those together. And the hash that you get out the end is always going to be different for every user because you've got different random bytes. Everyone gets their own salt, their own set of random bytes.
Well, how do you do that? Like, don't you got to store it somewhere? I mean, how?
Yeah. So then what you do is in the database, and this is exactly the way things like ASP.NET's membership provider from 2012 and earlier worked. It would take the salt that was generated and the hash, which is a combination of the salt and the password hash mm-hmm. together. Store that in the database. Then what happens is you come back later on and log in. You provide an email address and a password. System goes, okay, I'm going to take that email address, go to the database, get the account for that, bring back the salt and the hash. And now that I've got the salt, I can add it to the plain text password that you just provided at login, hash them together, compare it to the hash.
Yeah, but if you lost the database, you have the salt.
Yeah, but you can't do this anymore.
So I see.
Here's okay. why, and this is what people say, right? Okay. Like, you got the database anyway. These systems are designed to be resilient when someone gets everything. So if you get everything out of the database, what you're going to end up with is you're going to end up with all of these unique, never before seen hashes, caveat being so long as the same salt has never been used anywhere with the same password.
Right.
So it means you can't do this, we can't Google it, it means you can't use rainbow tables because rainbow tables are pre-computed values just of the plain text string. You'd literally have to have one rainbow table for every single password.
Which is not enough space in the universe.
Never going to happen. So we started doing this and we went, well, this is awesome, right? Like, now it's unbreakable. But the problem we've got now is that you can compute MD5 hashes so quickly that you can go through and have a great big password list, and then you can take that password list, add one user's salt to each one, and just keep hashing and hashing and hashing until you figure out what the actual password is.
And that's if they've used the same password that everyone knows about.
No. So even if you, let's say you go and create an entirely unique password. So you've got a unique password, there's a unique salt in the database. As an attacker, all you know is that there's a hash and there's a salt. You can create your own big word list, so you can work through a character range, or you can use a password dictionary, keep adding the salt, hashing them together, and then seeing if it matches the hash from the database. And all of this becomes a speed question. So I'll give you a really good example. We're looking at MD5. How many MD5 hashes do you think you could calculate per second on consumer-grade hardware?
Million.
25 billion. So this is the crazy. Most people say this, right? They go, okay,
I was like several orders of magnitude away from the right thing.
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
a bit more than several. But,
I'm not good at math. Thank you for that. But what I'm saying is that, like, even storing salted hashed passwords, if someone really wants to know your password, they can brute force it.
Well, possibly. And all of this is just a mathematical situation in terms of how many guesses can you make in how much time, and then how strong is the password.
And then the other thing that makes me ill is that some banks are like, your password can be only between 8 and 12 characters. It must have one of these and three of these. And you're like, that's a perfect algorithm that I can build to go through every single combination of that. And I bet I could, if I could do 25 billion a second, after a day of me trying, I bet I could figure it out if I have those things.
Yeah, so this is where none of this is anymore an exact science. So I'll come back to banks. On the speed thing, if you can do 25 billion guesses a second, not so good, right?
Yeah.
You're probably going to break a very large number of passwords in a very short time. But see here, we're not sort of using these absolute terms. You'll never get all of them because there'll be people like me that have a password manager and I've got 30 or 40 genuinely random characters in a password. Even at 25 billion guesses a second, good luck cracking that in any sort of reasonable, there's the other caveat, time frame. Maybe if you have a year with really fast machines and you've got a lot, you know. But it starts to get law of diminishing returns. So we sort of went, all right, well, look, this is too fast. So we've got to actually make things slower, which is really counterintuitive for developers, because what we're saying is this system that you're trying to optimize the nth degree out of, could you please make it a bit slower?
Like
much slower. So some of the algorithms we're seeing today, we're seeing adaptive hashing algorithms, which allow you to create workload to slow things down. So we've got PBKDF2 built into the .NET framework. Bcrypt is another really popular one. And they are literally running around about the 50 million times slower mark.
On purpose. They're hashing things slower on purpose.
Correct. So, and the interesting thing here is we can actually see observable delays in some of the applications now. So we can see that to log in, register, or change password, it can take several hundred milliseconds longer because you're adding workload to the system to slow it down such that if someone gets the passwords out, it's going to take them 50 million times longer to crack them. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be done, but they're going to get a significantly smaller amount in a significantly longer time.
So now it's a question of, if I'm a bad guy and I want to do this, it's a question of how much is it going to cost me to do this?
Yeah.
And the more you make it cost for them, because eventually you could break anything, right? But the more it costs for them, the less incentive they have.
So eventually can be multiple lifetimes.
So, well, that is definitely not cost effective.
But, you know, mind you, when we talk about GPUs that can sort of do 25 billion calculations a second, you can have as many GPUs as you like. And there are professional hash cracking organizations out there. A friend of mine runs one where he creates these rigs where they put 8 GPUs in there. So they're now doing 200 giga hashes per second with one of these. Now, let's say you're NSA and there was some really high value password. You'd go to this guy and you go, build me a dozen of those, you know? And now I'm not even sure what 2000 giga hashes a second is, but it's a lot, right?
Yeah.
So you take 10 of these and you put them all in a big rack and you parallelize the whole workload.
And that's because someone has said the cost of doing this is important, so we're going to do that.
Yeah, so you know what we're sort of doing here is we're saying that you have to think as an adversary, as an attacker, you have to think a lot more about what the value of the asset is. So it's going to cost you more and more and more, both in dollar and in time, to actually break hashes. And it's still not an absolute either. You know, you might have someone, let's say it's 100 characters. If you've got 100 genuinely random characters, even at 25 billion a second or 200 giga hashes a second, it's probably going to last an extremely long time.
But it's eventually going to be cracked.
So someone has to do the mathematics on that. I wonder if, for all intents and purposes, 100 genuinely random characters at 200 giga hashes a second still wouldn't be cracked.
Okay. So that and now because it feels like we went on this tangent, we really didn't, because now we're going back full circle to these files have been dumped that have these emails and these hashed passwords.
Yep.
We hope.
And so here's the interesting thing now. When we start to look at data breaches, I find it really curious to sort of see the internal mechanics of how people have built systems. And when we look even at the list we've got here on the screen, things like Dropbox were really interesting because Dropbox, 68 million accounts, including mine, including my wife's, by the way, it's lovely seeing yourself in these data breaches. I mean, it makes verification very easy, not so much fun otherwise.
Yeah.
So Dropbox had about half their passwords stored as SHA-1 hashes and about half of them stored as Bcrypt hashes, which is really interesting because it looks like they were sort of halfway through the rollover process of going from a known weak algorithm to a strong one. And around about the mid-2012 timeframe when they allegedly had the original breach is probably about the timeframe a lot of companies were starting to sort of say, well, there's this Moore's Law thing, computers are getting faster, we were able to calculate more hashes, we need to do things better. So we learn interesting things in seeing that. So we know now Dropbox is using Bcrypt. Dropbox actually has a really interesting blog post here, and if you do a little bit of a Google for Dropbox password storage, they've got a great article here, and I love the way Google can fix my terrible spelling too. Thank you, Google. How Dropbox securely stores your password. Now, the first thing I love about this is I love the transparency. And I would love to see more organizations say, this is how we do it. Because I'd like to see the hand forced, because the ones who don't want to own up to it, probably not doing such a good job. So we know that there are a lot of organizations still doing plain text. I saw a data breach this week in plain text. MD5 or SHA-1 with no salt, MD5 or SHA-1 with the salt. Dropbox says, here's what we're doing. We are actually using, we're taking your password, we're SHA-512 hashing it. because SHA-512 can retain a lot of entropy from the password, more entropy than Bcrypt, which it then wraps around it with a strength
of
10.
Holy cow.
And then, for good measure, we're going to encrypt all that.
So they're doing like SHA-512, Bcrypt, AE-256 on the top. So you're getting like garbage, garbage, garbage all the way at the end.
Yeah, except it's better than garbage because you can actually do something useful with it. So what they're doing is they're using SHA-512 to keep a lot of entropy in the password, which Bcrypt would otherwise truncate. They're using Bcrypt because that's then a very slow hashing algorithm, particularly with a work factor of 10 as they're using here. They're then using encryption. Now, let's be clear, hashing is not encryption.
No.
Because encryption has decryption.
Right.
You know, it's a different thing. So they're then encrypting it as well. And the joy of this is that if someone gets all of the Dropbox passwords, to begin with, they can't do anything unless they get the private key. And Dropbox is the sort of organization that you would expect, and I know that they had that incident, but you would expect today, knows how to protect a private key, and they'd have dedicated hardware security modules and things like that.
Okay, so Dropbox does all of this stuff. So this is better because now it's even harder for people to get into this.
So what I like about this is that this is a good mix of the security strengths of a strong hashing algorithm, plus the security strength of using AES-256 encryption. And you get the combined strength of both of these. If they were just doing encryption, we'd be a bit worried that if they lost the private key, plus of course someone has the ability to reverse passwords, but by putting a hash inside the encrypted data, well, you know, like you kind of don't have that problem anymore, and you actually get strength from both of these mechanisms.
Okay, so now that we've seen how people can potentially store passwords, you're getting these lists of username and passwords from specific, like where do you get these from? Is it just torrented somewhere? They're available for free? I hear that some companies, when they have a breach, they just give you the data.
Yeah, some of them do actually, a couple of them have. The Ethereum forum, as Ethereum as in the cryptocurrency. They got hacked recently and they reached out and said, look, you know, we've had an incident, we've notified people, but we want to increase awareness, and they donated the email addresses. So I loaded that in. But in answer to your other question about where do I get the data from, it's a combination of factors. Certainly in the early days, I would be trawling around the dark webs and the sorts of shady corners that people who have this sort of information would frequent. There are shady corners on the internet.
He shuts the door.
Well, for some particular breaches, yes. I do. We may not go into that here on the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that. But to be honest, these days, there's so many people that know what I do with the project and support it, that literally every day I will get multiple direct messages, emails, encrypted chats from people who say, hey, I've got a piece of data, would you like to add it? So pretty much every time these days when you see me adding a breach, someone has sent it to me. One of the things I've learned, which I never knew, but one of the things I've learned over the last few years running this is that there is a really strong trading scene predominantly occupied by kids or young males who exchange this data with each other. So they'll go, you know, hey, I've got the LinkedIn data breach. Have you got the Dropbox data breach.
Yeah.
So many data breaches.
Yeah.
Dropbox data breach. Would you like to swap? And of course, they swap, but they still have the original one.
Yeah,
it's not
like they're giving trading cards, right? Keep both.
This is the analogy I often make. It is a little bit like trading baseball cards in terms of the mentality of you have something I'd like, I have something that you'd like. Where it breaks down is like you say, you still have
cards.
The original. You get to keep both cards and you get to keep a perfect copy. And in many ways, this worries me a lot as well, because what we're seeing is your data, my data, our friends' data, not just email address and passwords, birth dates, sexual orientations, often very sensitive things, being shared and redistributed in ways that, you know, you can never put that genie back in the bottle, right?
Right.
There's so much info out there.
And so when you get these breaches, what are you storing? Because that might be a question like, holy cow, does Troy have all my data too? And I don't think you do that.
Yeah, so in terms of what actually goes into this site online, it is only ever email addresses. So
email addresses and the breach that it came from.
Yeah, and actually that's a fair point too, because there is an association implied by having the email address with the breach. So what it means is that my absolute worst case scenario in terms of the assets that are online in this Azure site is that you would know which email addresses are associated with which data breaches. Now, I don't want that to happen. Offsetting that, though, is that, first of all, a lot of this is available already. Yeah. Most of what you see on the screen here, let alone the ones that are here on the big list, you can go and find pretty easily. You know, a lot of them are just a Google search away. Many of them are on the clear web. So there's that. I made a really conscious decision not to put passwords or anything like that in the system, even though a lot of people have said, I would love to be able to figure out what password I used, because that is an enormous risk.
Oh, I know.
And we have seen multiple other services that have attempted to do similar things, sort of a data breach discovery, who've put sensitive data online and they've been shut down. They've been shut down either through legal threats by the sites that that they're putting the data up there for, or by law enforcement.
And so legally, it's not even worth doing, storing passwords.
Let's even put the legal bit aside for a moment, because that is an absolute quagmire. You've got different jurisdictions, you've got different...
Looking here and I can see stuff from everywhere.
But if we think about this from an ethical perspective, to have people's passwords, and we just talked about how much work you've got to put into properly protecting passwords with hashes, to then say, I'm going to take passwords that in many cases are still plain text or very weak hashes, and I'm just going to dump them all on a site, I mean, that is massively reckless.
Yeah.
And there have been services out there that have sold access to everyone's password to anyone who would pay for it, often single dollar amounts. And, you know, fortunately, that sort of thing eventually gets shut down, as we've seen very recently. But, I mean, oh, man, look, that is just such volatile data.
So when I go to your site, and how do I use it? You just go there and put your email in there?
Yeah, so you literally just go to the homepage and you go, okay, what is my email address? I plug it in and it's going to come back. And, I mean, let's do test@example.com. We know that this guy is going to be pwned many, many times over. So you go there. Test@example.com hasn't had a real good time of it because they have been in 31 separate data breaches, which hasn't been real good. Maybe not the most legitimate
accounts.
All right,
I'm going to test an email here that I haven't used in a long time that all my garbage goes to. I don't ever check this. Suarez1979@hotmail.com and pwned.
Wow. There you go, two data breaches. So if you scroll down a little bit, you have been on Last.fm and very embarrassingly, MySpace.
I created an account when it was popular. This account when I was like 14 years old. You're like, I got to get a MySpace account. I think I got an account and didn't do anything with it. Should I be embarrassed about
that's
MySpace?
That's some really quick.
Me I need to be embarrassed about
really
MySpace.
Quick backpedaling, isn't it? I was young. I was curious. Young.
I didn't know anything. I was stupid. Gosh, that's amazing.
Now, There's a caveat here as well, though, because you'll see here it says subscribe to search sensitive breaches. Now, I'm not saying you have been in a sensitive breach, but if you were young and curious and you signed up to certain websites of certain ill repute, and I flagged those as sensitive, so yeah, being serious for a moment, anything where I think public discovery would put someone at a heightened sense of risk. Ashley Madison's a perfect example. There are other websites, there are even dating websites, could put people at a heightened sense of risk if others are able to discover that you are on the site. So I've said you've got to subscribe to search sensitive breaches. So you can go, hey, subscribe like this. What will happen here? Do you just want to plug your email address back into there? What we'll do now is go, okay, this will send you an email with a unique link in it. And you got to prove that you're not a robot here.
I don't even know the password to this email anymore. If I'm
well, you may never even get it then. But under normal circumstances, you go, okay, subscribe me. You then get an email and it says, hey, click here. And then, because you've now verified that you control the email address. Takes you to a page which says, all right, here's all your public stuff, which we know is two, and any private ones. Now, in fairness as well, you can be in sensitive data breaches that you never even know. So literally last week, I loaded one for JustDate.com. And JustDate.com is what it sounds like it is. And the reason I loaded it last week is I introduced the concept of a fabricated breach. And what happens here is there are data breaches that people misrepresent. So they get a whole heap of data.
Oh my gosh.
And then they go, in this case, here's 24 million records from JustDate.com. Now, I put a huge amount of work into verification because I don't want to put a data breach on there and go, hey, this is just date, and then them go, no, it's not. you know, like it, yeah. it actually, and you know, for me to be wrong, so I don't want that. But the problem is that you got 24 million people whose email address is in here and it's being shared around and people are saying this person was on
thisdate.com.
So anyway, I introduced this concept and I make it crystal clear all the way through. I don't think, I'm almost certain that they haven't had a data breach. However, your data was in here. Now I loaded this and then I got an email saying that I, Troy Hunt, was in the JustDate.com data breach. So first thing I did is explain to my wife that I was not in the JustDate.com data breach. Second thing is, because I had the data, I actually looked at my data and my birth date was about 20 years off and, you know, like it was definitely fabricated data. But I guess the point I'm making here is that you may find yourself in places that you never expected. And when you actually look at it, you go, wow, I was in that thing.
Can you imagine like using, like weaponizing that? Like for example, there was an Ashley Madison dump.
Yeah.
Could you imagine a similar type dump where people are faking the dump and adding emails just to blackmail people?
Well, look, this is the thing, and it's one of the reasons why I flagged Ashley Madison as sensitive and made it not searchable, because there were many, many men, almost all men, strangely enough, who said, I never had an account on there. Some of them were probably right. Some of them. I suspect that has now become known as the Ashley Madison defense. Mm-hmm. I didn't create the account. Could have been anybody. Because I can sign anybody up to Ashley Madison. You know, I can sign anybody up to any website. It's just an email address. Now, I can't necessarily get a verification email, but a lot of sites don't need that. And a lot of sites, most sites, almost every site, will still store the data of the registration even if you never verify. So I guess that the sort of the interesting lesson there is that you could be in all sorts of places that you never expected, either because someone else has signed you up or someone has fabricated a data breach. Or I end up writing a whole blog post about why am I in a data breach that I just didn't expect to be in. And there are things like companies get acquired. So you end up under a brand that you may not recognize. Companies buy mailing lists. You know, there are all these reasons why you may be somewhere you never expected. And what I like about this project is that there's a bunch of people who are now discovering that they're in places that are entirely foreign to them. And the only reason they know is that there's a way of discovering that.
So how many records do you have in this database?
Depends on what we're looking at. In terms of the number of data breaches, we've got 191 websites which have been loaded in. And that is comprising of about 2.1 billion accounts at the moment. So an account is an instance of someone being breached on a website. So of those 2.1 billion accounts, there's about 1.5 billion unique email addresses, which is a fairly sizable percentage of the world.
That's like a seventh of the world.
It's even more than that, because if you take the number of internet-connected people in the world, which I think is around about the 3 billion mark, 3 to 4 billion
mark. That's a third of anyone that has the ability to create an account.
That's a lot.
So there was an instance where, because this all runs on Azure, and the back end, is it DocumentDB, is that right?
No, it's Table Storage.
Table Storage. So there was an instance where I think you were skiing and there was a particular dump that all of a sudden hit the fan.
I was snowboarding when the Ashley Madison data hit. And in case people looking at it going, no, he wasn't, that's August. We're upside down here.
Yeah, it's really hot right now, actually, and it's February.
So you're in Feb, we're sweltering here at the moment. In August, I was literally on the snow in Australia and I was snowboarding with my son. And, you know, this thing has happened, and it was a massive story. Like, even by today's standards, Ashley Madison was just a massive story. And I was there, and I had my iPhone, and fortunately, I have a Plus, so I got the big one.
Yeah.
And I was literally there. I'd get on the chairlift, right? And I'm on the chairlift, got my gloves off, and I'm sort of RDPing into machines up there in West US Data Center, provisioning instances, loading data, and then I'd snowboard back down the mountain. And I'd get back on the chair, and, you know, and it's... What blew me away is the fact that I could be there in the snow in August, which blows a lot of people away. Yeah, in the middle of nowhere, and I'm like controlling the cloud, and I'm spinning stuff up, and I'm making stuff on the other side of the world work. And that, to me, even though I've been doing this for a couple of decades, was kind of like, what an amazing kind of time we live in.
What kind of volume increase did you see? Because I don't think people have an understanding of like, people, like, if you're successful, one of the problems in a website, if you're successful, is you could hurt yourself. You could DDoS yourself just because everyone thinks it's so popular. So what? Tell me the kind of volume.
Yeah, so then this is a really interesting thing, right? DDoSing yourself through popularity, which is a great problem to have, by the way.
Yes.
You want to have this problem. Ashley Madison, in some ways, it wasn't as bad as some recent incidents, and I'll talk about those as well. But it got a huge amount of worldwide attention. And it got a lot of attention because it was such a large event of such a sensitive nature. And I got the data in Have I Been Pwned really quickly, in part because I could be on the chairlift doing this. Got the data in there really quickly, so I got picked up by a lot of media. And what I was finding is a very rapid but sort of sustained incremental increase of traffic. And what I did is, this all runs on the Azure app service, so it's all platform as a service, which is awesome. I strongly recommend not having your own servers.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants to patch those things, yeah.
So, yeah, I was running there on PaaS, and I went, okay, I'll be a little bit cautious, I'll scale up. So I was running S3, which I think we're still calling large at the time, which is sort of 4 cores and I think 7 gigabytes of RAM. You know, like a reasonable size web server. And then I was using autoscale, and autoscale would go, look, once my CPU gets to a certain threshold over a certain amount of time, add on another instance. So scaling out, right? We're adding. Yeah. And I found that a combination of me going, I know it's going to be busy, so I'm going to up the scale a little bit, with let's add more instances as we need them, meant that I didn't lose any traffic. And my availability when I did the stats later on was literally 100.00%, which was kind of amazing. The cost of the entire thing over this sort of...
I bet you were like pooping your pants thinking, holy cow, I just scaled up and had millions and millions of users. I'm going to have to pay a lot of money for this.
Well, this was the thing. I was picturing this discussion with my wife where I was going to be going, well, you know, we're not going to the snow next year because... but what I found is that it ended up costing, I think it was somewhere in the order of about $100. And I wrote all this up, Lessons from Ashley Madison, if anyone wants to search for it. And that the reason why is that when you look at the actual cost per minute of running these app services, and it is billed down to the minute level, this is not even the hourly level. SQL databases are hourly, this is minute. You know, when you're adding stuff on, the cost of running for even days, running multiple large instances, it ended up, like I say, about $100. It's a nice dinner out with your wife. So that was really surprising that I had such high availability at such low cost. Now, of course, if I kept running that scale for long periods of time,
yeah, it'd be a lot of money.
It's going to get expensive. But if the service was so popular that it demanded running at such a large scale for a long period of time, then that's okay. I've got something really valuable now, right? So it does kind of go both ways there.
So tell us how this thing is built.
Okay, so as I mentioned, it is running on app service. So we are running on effectively IIS as a service. It's right. All ASP.NET MVC on the front end. The back end is a hybrid of two different data structures. So we've got SQL Azure, the platform as a service model of SQL Azure, and we've also got Azure Table Storage. And, you know, this is a really interesting thing. This is what my Ignite talk, actually, in a couple of days down here in Australia is going to be about, how to use these constructs in cost-effective ways. I find it really interesting that the traditional thinking is, you're building a web app, you're going to need a database.
Right.
If you're going to need a database, it's got to be a SQL database. Mm-hmm. Like, this was the chosen path.
And it's the canonical way we were taught originally.
Well, this was the way. We didn't have a lot of choice then. What we have now is we have options. So you just mentioned DocumentDB, I've mentioned table storage, and of course there's SQL. What I like about today's model is you can sort of go, I have all these different things, and each one does some things better and some things worse. Now what table storage does really well, which is what I'm using for the 2.1 billion accounts, is first of all, it's very cheap. So it's costing me with 2.1 billion accounts and often millions of queries a day, because you pay both for the storage and the number of queries. It's costing me, if we put it in US dollars, I think it's around about $35-40 US a month. Now that's...
For 2 billion records.
2 billion records.
Accessed millions of times.
Accessed millions of times per day. And not only that, but it has always had a perfectly flat performance profile. So I've never seen any latency. I've never seen any latency at the table storage level when there's been millions of people a day come to the site. I haven't seen any change in latency from the original 155 million odd accounts to the 2.1 billion accounts. And I'm sort of waiting for the day when I go, oh, it's going a bit slow now. And it hasn't happened.
It's like performance flat, exactly the same for the whole time.
Been linear the whole way through. And believe me, I watch this really closely. So that is fantastic, and that is what table storage does really well. It allows you to have very large amounts of data with very high utilization with a very predictable performance profile at a really low price. What it does bad is ad hoc queries. Now, this all comes down to the way you structure your storage as well. So within table storage, you can have multiple tables. Within a table, you can have partitions, and then every partition has rows. So the way I designed this is I said, let's have one table for all of this data. Let's name each partition after the domain. So there's a gmail.com partition, there's an outlook.com partition. And let's use the alias of the email address as the row key. So what it means is that when we look at what you just searched for up here, and we take your alias, there is a row key. All right, so it's got a good index on it. It then searches through hotmail.com, which is a partition. So you're going down to a very, very well optimized
index. You're partitioning the data in a really nice way.
Correct. It also means that I can do things like domain searches, because I have a feature up here, a little link here, domain search, where if you own a domain, you can say, I would like to see everything on my domain. And what we're doing then is we're just pulling the partition. You wouldn't want to pull the hotmail.com partition, because it's going to be a little bit big.
Yeah.
But for almost anything that is not an email provider or an ISP, even if there's tens of thousands of records in there, you just pick up the partition and go, here you go. That works great. Now, if you were to say, I would like to find my alias on every partition, it would be terrible. It would be absolutely terrible.
They're looking bottom up instead of top down.
That's it. If I wanted to say, give me everyone who was in, say, the Adobe data breach, again, terrible.
Right.
In fact, I've had to do this at times, and the only way I've been able to do it is to download all the data locally, then it just doesn't work well. So this is why I also use a SQL database. So I have an RDBMS in there, which again is SQL Platform as a Service. And then every time you go through and you do something like this notification here, or every time I load data into the system and I need to process it and figure out how many of my subscribers are in this data, that's what SQL Server does well.
I see.
And SQL Server is very effective at doing that, but SQL Server gets very expensive if you want to do 2.1 billion records and a couple of hundred gigabytes of data. So what I do there is I run a really small scale of SQL Server. I run, I think it's an S1 scale, which is around about $30 a month. So similar sort of cost to table storage, but it doesn't perform well if I need to do any expensive queries. But that is not sort of a business as usual process. So the normal operation of the site doesn't do expensive queries.
I see.
If I have to load in a big data breach, so these days, if I go much over a couple of million records, I go into my portal and I say, I'd like a bigger database. And it goes, okay, here's a bigger database. You're gonna pay an extra $2 to run this for the next few hours. I load the data and then I go, okay, now I go back. So I just scale up and down when I need to, because the only usage profiles which justify scaling up and down are the ones that I manually invoke anyway.
Ingest, yeah. This is amazing. And so this site, you should go to it. It's haveibeenpwned.com. Put your email in there and see if you have been pwned. This has been super awesome. I feel like since we're in Australia and it's the summertime, we should go do something fun.
Yeah, we should go get wet.
All right, let's do it.
It's Australia and it's summer, so it's pretty much all outside. So
is your backyard. Is this a lake, a river, or what is this?
This is a tidal flow. So this is salt water.
Sorry.
We get a lot of fish in here. I get a lot of dolphins in here too, actually.
Dolphins.
So I normally when I get up in the morning, I get up pretty early and I sit just here and I have a coffee. And we see dolphins and stuff come past here.
What do you want to do? What's the funnest thing that you do? Because I've seen pictures of you making fun of all of us on the other side of the planet. When it's cold, you're on your jet ski all the time.
Yeah, well, we're kind of on there when it's cold at your place or when it's hot in your place. And this is a nice spot. This place has 300 days of sunshine a year. So all year round, we're in the water. It is the hottest day that I've seen here. It's 38 degrees out here at the moment, Celsius, which means you're going to want to be in the water one way.
I'm getting a little warm here. So let's go.
All right, paddleboard.
I feel like this is what a sausage feels like when you stuff him into I'm in a really tight tube sock. Is this normal? He let me borrow his shirt.
I'm not going to make comments on the appearance of.
I feel like.
We'll let the viewers judge.
Suck it in. Let's go. All right, so what is this, man? This beautiful spread here.
Yeah, so we've got a bunch of cooked prawns, green prawns, mud crabs. These are the same as what we pull out of the backyard of our place, which is nice.
It's a pretty popular place.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long have you guys been brothers? Did you start out as a programmer and then become like a security guy? Or did you start out as a security guy and then do programming? How did it work for you?
Yeah, it was more the developer background. So actually I started out like when I was a teenager doing more kind of pulling machines apart. I had a couple of part-time jobs doing sort of PC repair stuff. And then I showed you that book at home, the HTML5 for Dummies, right? Which was from 1995. And that was when I started really doing development. So I started doing web development for many, many, many years. Went on and did that thing where when you get good at development, you're meant to stop doing it and you're meant to do something else. So I became an architect.
Sure. That means we write a lot of code that maybe we don't need to.
We draw diagrams, you know, like we do a lot of diagrams.
Yes.
And so yeah, I was doing that, and then I started focusing more on security as I was writing my blog, and I just kind of drifted in that way because I was seeing a lot of software developers really struggle with security principles. And particularly in the corporate environment I was in, we'd see all the time security teams would give them all these big documents of you've done this wrong, this wrong, this wrong. The developers would just go, what's that? What do the acronyms mean?
Because we really, like as a dev, I thought about security last. Like I would make everything else and then I'd be like, oh, I got to make a password thing so they can log in.
Oh, it's a very implicit sort of requirement. And I think that's part of it too, right? In terms of requirements, when you look at what people ask in order to build a system, they'll go, you know, we want this feature and that feature. And there is this implicit expectation that it will be fast, it will be scalable, it will be secure. And very often, these things are not spelled out in any sort of raw terms. We just kind of expect people to do it. And sometimes they do it.
So how long did it take you to convert from dev to pure security? Are you always in between?
Yeah, look, I'm always in between. I mean, we were talking about have I been pwned? That is all my dev work.
Yeah.
And all the Azure stuff I do is all my dev work. A lot of the courses I write, the talk I'm doing for Ignite in a couple of days, is dev work. And you know that is a really important part of it. And I don't want to be just a security person. I'm trying to bridge this gap. And if I stop living in the dev world and I just live in the security world, I'm not going to be able to do that.
I see. So for someone that's a dev right now that's watching, what suggestions do you have to be like, look, here is how I sort of got into security? Because right now, like if you're a security person, I mean, you have a lot of options because there's not very many good ones, right? So how can I, as a dev, sort of start working my way towards doing more security type stuff?
So the easy self-ingratiating answer is go and watch my courses. So there's that. There are many, many wonderful Pluralsight courses. But I guess in all seriousness, I think that for devs, that there's got to be this level of endorsement, right? Like you got to kind of go, I'm actually interested in this thing. And there almost needs to be something that kind of switches to go, look, this is actually something I'm willing to invest time in. Now, for me, there were sort of multiple drivers, but part of it was that as I started playing with security, I was like, this is actually pretty cool. This is good fun, right?
Right.
Like I was having fun pulling things apart, seeing how they work, breaking them. And I think as developers, we have this exploratory kind of mindset where we want to try and do this stuff. So, you know, like get in there and start seeing how SQL injection works, not in other people's websites.
Yeah.
There are many dedicated projects for this, including one that I have that I use in my Pluralsight course.
Oh, that's right. You can go in there and break stuff.
You can go to hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com, hack
break
stuff
it.
And not go to jail.
Don't
really
you like reset it every night or something?
I reset it on a regular basis after there is too much inappropriate material there.
So it's hack yourself.
Hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com.
Hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com.
And a lot of the, I've done a course called Hack Yourself First. A lot of the workshops I do are called Hack Yourself First. And the premise for developers is to get this mindset where it's like, let's break our own things and learn how to break our own things. And when we realize how easy it is to do that, let's then start to talk about the security practices.
I see.
Because I reckon if you're just there trying to build secure code and you don't know how the exploits work, you're missing a big part of the picture.
I see. So tell me what the spread we got here, because I'm all about food.
Yeah.
What did we get? I think we got the big one.
We got everything.
Fish and
like we got everything.
Those are fish.
So we got fish and chips.
Chips.
We've got, what's in here? They...
calamari.
Potato cakes there. There's potato, we've got calamari. Some of these are prawns, battered prawns.
Oh, yeah.
More fish, more lemon, more fish. Have we got enough?
And there's salad for the lightweights.
So for everyone's reference, there are actually people over here that are going to eat it too.
No, it's just me and Troy, man. And we're going to put it in fast forward and just eating and just looking sick and throwing up. All right, well, let's dig in.
All right, let's eat.
Is there like weird animals here that we can go look at?
Yeah.
You told me there's wallabies on some of these islands.
You may not want to find some of the animals that are up there.
Are they like snakes and spiders
and stuff?
Yeah,
no, there'll be snakes and all that sort of thing. Be lots of those. What else do we have? We may not have many wallabies here. Just over there is another island, that's South Stratty. That goes for probably about 30 kilometers north. Heaps of wallabies there, heaps of snakes, which we've seen all of. We normally see a lot of dolphins around here as well, which is kind of nice. So it's just a nice sort of natural
area.
Dude,
you live like in a magical place.
Yeah, I know. I know.
All right, goodness. All right, well, let's wrap it up.
All right.
Let's head off that way. We're going to ride off into the sunset on his awesome...
on the jet ski.
Yeah, let's do it. Well, it's time to say goodbye to Troy. And he's going to whisk me off in this beautiful man machine. I will see you next time. Next time on the MVP show. I traveled to the charming city of Stavanger, Norway to meet with .NET MVP, Iris Claussen. Iris talked with me about microservice deployment, models, security, and multi-tenant authentication. And oh yeah, she made me do physical exercise. Yeah. All right, this is kind of steep, Iris.